Now I better understood why the images received were less luminous than on our preceding stops. However, the close-ups were excellent. Just then, on the panel, we had a shot of a face apparently that of a female. It was really horrible. The poor creature had an enormous gash where her left eye should have been. Her mouth was positioned to the right of her face and appeared as a tiny little opening in the middle of her jaw, around which were lips that seemed fused together. On the top of her head, a single tuft of hair hung pitifully. We could now see her breasts, and very pretty they would have been, if one of them hadn't had a purulent wound on the side. With breasts like that, she must be young? I asked. The computer puts the age at 19 years. Radiation? Of course. Other people appeared, some of whom were perfectly normal looking. There were males among them, with an athletic build, who looked to be in their 20s. What is the age of the oldest? Do you know? At present, we have no record of anyone older than 38 years, and a year on this planet is 295 days of 27 hours. Now, if you look at the screen, you can see a close-up of the genital area of that handsome and athletic young man. As you will note, the genitals are totally atrophied. We've already worked out, from previous expeditions, that there are very few men actually capable of procreation, and yet, there are great numbers of children. It's the survival instinct of all races to reproduce as soon as possible. Thus, the obvious solution would be that the males capable of reproduction are studs. This man must be one of them, I think. Indeed, the camera was showing a man of about 30 years perhaps, possessing physical attributes certainly capable of producing offspring. We were also able to see many children coming and going around small fires on which food was cooking. The men and women seated around the fireplaces were taking cooked pieces and sharing them with the children. The fires seemed like wood fires, but I couldn't be sure. They were fueled by something shaped rather like stones. Behind the fires, slabs similar to the boats seen earlier were piled and assembled so as to form shelters that looked quite comfortable. In the camera's field of vision, no trees could be seen. Perhaps they did exist, because I had noticed green patches earlier as we flew over the continent. From between two huts, some little black pigs appeared, pursued by three furious yellow dogs, only to disappear rapidly behind another hut. I was dumbfounded and couldn't help but wonder if I really was looking down on another planet. These humans looked like me, or rather, like Polynesians, and here were dogs and pigs. It was all more and more surprising. The sphere began to return, as did the other spheres no doubt, that were being monitored by screens I couldn't easily see from my position. The operation return to ship was initiated, and all the spheres reabsorbed without incident, the same as before. I assumed we were about to leave again and so installed myself comfortably in my seat, allowing the force field to restrain me thus. Some moments later, the suns of the planet appeared, two in number, then everything dwindled rapidly, just as it had done when we left Earth. After a time, which seemed quite short, the force field was neutralized and I understood that I was free to get out of my seat. This was a good feeling. I noticed Thau heading towards me accompanied by two of the oldest, if I can say so, of her companions. I remained standing beside my seat before the three astronauts. In order to look at Thau, I was already obliged to raise my head, but when she introduced me, in French, to the elder of them, I felt even smaller. The latter was easily a head taller than Thau. I was completely astonished when she, by Astra, spoke to me correctly, although slowly, in French. She placed her right hand on my shoulder, saying, "I am delighted to have you on board, Michel. I hope that all is well with you and that it continues to be so. May I present Latley, the second in charge of our spacecraft, myself being what you would call commander-in-chief of the Elitora." Elitora, in their language, is the name given to their super-long-distance spacecraft. Turning to Latley, she spoke a few words in her own language and Latley too, placed her hand on my shoulder. With a warm smile, She repeated my name several times, slowly, as would someone who had difficulty pronouncing a new language. Her hand remained on my shoulder and a feeling of well-being, a definite fluid sensation, passed through my body. I was so obviously overcome by this, that the three of them began to laugh. Reading my thoughts, Tha reassured me. Michelle, Lackley possesses a special gift, although not rare among our people. What you have been able to experience, is a fluid which is magnetic and beneficial, and which emanated from her. It's wonderful. I exclaimed. Please compliment her on my behalf one. I then addressed the two astronauts. Thank you for your welcome, but I must confess I am absolutely astounded by what is happening to me. It really is the most incredible adventure for an Earthling such as me. Although I have always believed in the possibility that other planets might be inhabited by human-like beings, I'm still having a hard time convincing myself that this is not a fantastic dream. I had often discussed things such as telepathy, extraterrestrials and what we call flying saucers with friends on Earth, but they were just words and grand phrases uttered in ignorance. Now I have the proof of what I had suspected for so long regarding the existence of parallel universes, the duality of our beings, and other unexplained occurrences. To experience all that I have in these last few hours is so exciting it takes my breath away. Lackley, admiring my monologue, uttered an exclamation, in words I didn't understand but which Thou immediately translated for me. Lackley understands your state of mind perfectly well, Michelle. As do I, added by Astra. How could she have understood what I said? She has dipped telepathically into your mind while you were speaking. As you must realize, telepathy is not hindered by language barriers. My astonishment amused them and perpetual smiles played on their lips. By Astra addressed me. Michelle, I am going to introduce you to the rest of the crew. If you will kindly follow me. She guided me, by the shoulder, to the furthest desk, where three astronauts were monitoring the instruments. I hadn't yet approached these desks and, even in astral body, I had not paid any attention to the readout of these computers. The glance I now gave them immobilized me completely. The numerals before my eyes were in Arabic. I know the reader will be as surprised as I was, but it was fact. The ones, twos, threes, fours, etc. appearing on the monitors, were the same numerals that occur on Earth. By Astra noticed my astonishment. It is true, isn't it, Michelle? For you there is one surprise after another. Don't think we are having fun at your expense, as we totally understand your wonder. All will fall into place in good time. For the moment please allow me to introduce Neola. The first of the astronauts rose and turned towards me. She placed her hand on my shoulder, as by Astra and Lackley had done. It occurred to me that this gesture must correspond to a handshake. Neola addressed me in her own language and then she, too, repeated my name three times, as if she wanted to commit it to memory forever. She was about the same size as thou. The same ceremony followed each time I was introduced. And thus I officially made the acquaintance of all the members of the crew. There was a striking resemblance between them. Their hair, for example, varied only in length and shade, which ranged from a dark copper to a light golden blonde. Some had longer or broader noses than others, but all had eyes of a color which tended towards light rather than dark, and all had very neat, well-shaped ears. Lackley, by Astra and Thou invited me to sit down in one of the comfortable seats. When we were all comfortably installed, by Astra moved her hand in a particular way near the armrest of her seat and I saw coming towards us, floating in the air, four round trays. Each carried a container of yellowish liquid and a bowl of something whitish with a consistency similar to fairy floss but in granulated form. Flat tongs served as forks. The trays came to rest on the arms of our seats. I was quite intrigued. Thou suggested, if I wished to partake of this refreshment, I might like to follow her lead. She sipped from her glass and I did likewise, finding it quite a pleasant tasting drink, similar to a water honey mixture. My companions used the tongs to eat the mixture in the bowls. Following their example, I tasted for the first time what we, on Earth, called manna. Similar to bread, it is, however, extremely light and without any particular flavor. I had eaten only half the amount in my bowl when already, I felt satisfied, which surprised me considering the consistency of this food. I finished my drink and, although I couldn't say I'd dined in fine style, I experienced a sense of well-being and was neither hungry nor thirsty. Perhaps you would have preferred a French dish, Michel? Asked Thou, a smile twitching on her lips. I merely smiled, but Biastra snorted. Just then, a signal drew our attention to the panel. In the center, and in close-up, appeared the head of a woman, resembling my hostess's. She spoke rapidly. My companions turned slightly in their seats to better attend to what was being said. Naola, at her desk, entered into a dialogue with the figure on the screen, just as our television interviewers do on Earth. Imperceptibly, the shot changed from the close-up to a wide angle, revealing a dozen women each in front of a desk. Thou took me by the shoulder and guided me over to Naola, installing me in a seat in front of one of the screens. She took a seat next to me and addressed the people on the monitor. She spoke for some time, rapidly, in her melodious voice, turning frequently towards me. From all evidence, I was the main topic of conversation. When she had finished, the woman reappeared in close-up, responding in several brief sentences. To my great surprise, her eyes fixed on me and she smiled. "Hello, Michel. We wish you a safe arrival on Thyre Uber." She waited for my reply. When I had overcome my surprise, I expressed warm thanks. This, in turn, elicited exclamations and numerous comments from her companions, appearing again in a wide-angle shot on the screen. "Did they understand?" I asked Thou. "Telepathically, yes, but they are delighted to hear someone from another planet speak his own language. For most of them, this is quite a rare experience." Excusing herself, Thou readdressed the screen and, what I assumed was a technical conversation, ensued, including Biastra. Eventually, after a smile in my direction and a "see you soon," the picture was cut. I say cut because the screen did not simply become blank, rather, the image was replaced by a beautiful, soft color, a mixture of green and indigo blue, which produced a sense of contentment. It gradually faded after a minute or so. Turning to Thou, I asked what it had all meant. Had we rendezvoused with another spacecraft, and what was this Theuba or Theola? "Thyre Uber, Michel, is the name we have given to our planet, just as you call yours Earth. Our intergalactic base has been in touch with us, as we will be arriving in Thyre Uber in 16 of your Earth hours and 35 minutes. This she had checked with a glance at the nearest computer. "Those people then, are technicians on your planet?" "Yes, as I just said, at our intergalactic base. This base monitors our spacecraft continually, and if we were in trouble for technical or human reasons, in 81% of cases, they would be able to control our safe return to port." This did not particularly surprise me, as I had realized I was dealing with a superior race, whose technological possibilities were beyond my comprehension. What did occur to me was that, not only this spacecraft, but also the intergalactic base appeared to be manned by only women. An all-female team such as this would be quite exceptional on Earth. I wondered if Thyre Uber was populated only by women. Like space Amazons. I smiled at the image. I have always preferred the company of women rather than men. It was quite a pleasant thought. My question to Thou was direct. "Are you from a planet solely populated by women?" She looked at me with apparent surprise, then her face lit up with amusement. I was a little concerned. Had I said something stupid? She took me by the shoulder and asked that I follow her. We left the control room and immediately entered a smaller room, called the Halus, which had quite a relaxing ambience. Thou explained that we would not be interrupted in the room, since the occupants acquired, by their presence, the right to absolute privacy. She invited me to choose one of the many seats that furnished the room. Some were like beds, some like armchairs, others resembled hammocks, while others again, were like high stools with adjustable backs. I would have been difficult to please if one of them did not suit my requirements. Once settled comfortably in a kind of armchair with Thao facing me, I watched, as her face became serious again. She started to speak. "Michelle, there are no women aboard this spacecraft." If she had told me that I wasn't on a spaceship but rather, in the Australian desert, I would have more readily believed her. Seeing the expression of disbelief on my face, she added, "Neither are there any men." At this, my confusion was absolute. "But," I faltered, "you are, what? Just robots?" "No, I think you misunderstand. In a word, Michelle, we are hermaphrodites. You know, of course, what an hermaphrodite is." I nodded, quite dumbfounded, and then asked, "Is your whole planet inhabited only by hermaphrodites?" "Yes." "And yet your face and mannerisms are more feminine than masculine." "Indeed. It might appear so, but believe me when I tell you that we are not women, but hermaphrodites. Our race has always been this way. I must confess, this is all very confusing. I'm going to find it difficult to think of you as he rather than a she I have done since I've been among you. You have nothing to imagine, my dear. We are simply what we are, human beings from another planet living in a world different from yours. I can understand you would like to define us as one sex or the other, for you think as an Earthling and a Frenchman. Perhaps, for once, you could make use of the neutered gender of English and think of us as it." I smiled at this suggestion but continued to feel disoriented. Only moments ago, I had believed myself to be among Amazons. "But how can reproduction of your race occur?" I asked. "Can an hermaphrodite reproduce?" "Of course we can, exactly as you do on Earth, the only difference being that we genuinely control the births, but that is another story. In good time, you will understand, but now we should rejoin the others." We returned to the control post, and I found myself looking at these astronauts with new eyes. Looking at the chin of one, I found it to be more masculine than it had seemed earlier. Another's nose was decidedly masculine, and the hairstyles of some were now more manly. It occurred to me that we really do see people as we think they are and not as they are. In order to feel less embarrassed among them, I created a rule for myself. I had taken them to be women, as to me they were more like females than males, thus I would continue to think of them as women and we'd see how that worked. From where I was, I could follow, on the central panel, the movement of stars as we proceeded on our way. Sometimes they appeared enormous and blinding as we passed by a little too closely, a few million kilometers from them. At times too, we noticed planets of strange colors. I remember one was of an emerald green, so pure I was stunned. It resembled an enormous jewel. Thao approached and I took advantage of the opportunity to ask her about a band of light that had appeared at the base of the screen. This light was composed of what looked like millions of tiny explosions. These are caused by our antimatter guns, as you would call them on Earth, and are, in fact, explosions. At the speed at which we travel, the most minuscule of meteorites would shatter this spacecraft were we to hit it. So, we make use of specific rooms to store certain forms of dust under enormous pressure, and this is fed into our antimatter guns. Our vessel could be considered to be a cosmotron, firing streams of accelerated particles that disintegrate the most microscopic of errant bodies in space, for great distances ahead and to the sides of our spacecraft. This is what allows us to attain speeds that we can. Around our vessel, we create our own magnetic field. "Oh please, not so fast. As you know Thao, I have no scientific background and if you speak of cosmotrons and accelerated particles, you are going to lose me. I understand the principle, which is certainly very interesting, but I'm not good on technical terms. Can you tell me instead, why the planets on the screen are colored the way they are?" sometimes because of their atmospheres and sometimes because of the gases which surround them. Do you see a multicolored point with a tail, at the right of the screen? The thing was approaching at high speed. Second by second we were better able to admire it. It seemed to explode constantly and change form, its colors indescribably rich. I looked at Thou. It's a comet, she said. It completes revolution around its sun in approximately 55 of your Earth years. How far are we from it? She glanced at the computer, for 150,000 kilometers. Thou, I said, how is it you use the numerals of Arabic? And when you speak of kilometers, are you translating for me, or do you actually use this measure? No. We count in Kato and Taki. We use the numerals that you recognize as Arabic, for the simple reason that it is our own system, one which we took to Earth. What? Please explain further. Michelle, we have several hours before arriving at Thyr Uba. This is probably the best time to start educating you seriously on certain matters. If you don't mind, we'll go back to the Halys, where we were before. I followed Thyr, my curiosity stronger than ever. 3. The first man on Earth, once comfortably re-established in the Halys, the relaxation room previously described, Thou began her strange recital. Michelle, 1,350,000 years ago precisely, on the planet Bakar 18 of the constellation Centaur, a decision was made by the leaders of that planet, following numerous conferences and reconnaissance expeditions, to send inhabited vessels to the planets Mars and Earth. There was a very simple reason for this: their planet was cooling down internally and would become uninhabitable within 500 years. They thought, with good reason, that it was preferable to evacuate their people to a younger planet of the same category. What do you mean by the same category? I will explain later. To do so now would be premature. Going back to these people, I must tell you that these beings were human, very intelligent and highly evolved. A black race, they had thick lips, flattened noses and frizzy hair, resembling, in these ways, the blacks now living on Earth. These people had inhabited the planet Bakar 18 for 800,000 years, in cohabitation with a yellow-colored race. To be precise, this was what you call on Earth, the Chinese race, and they had inhabited Bakar 18 for about 400 years prior to the blacks. The two races witnessed numerous revolutions during their time on the planet. We tried to provide relief, assistance and guidance, but, in spite of our intervention, wars broke out periodically. These, along with the natural disasters occurring on the planet, served to thin the ranks in both races. Finally, a nuclear war broke out on such a grand scale that the entire planet was plunged into darkness and temperatures fell to minus 40 of your degrees Celsius. Not only did atomic radiation destroy the population, but cold and lack of food accomplished the rest. From page 30, it is a recorded fact that a mere 150 black people and 85 yellow people survived the catastrophe, from a population of 7 billion black and 4 billion yellow humans. A register of survivors was taken just before they began to reproduce and when they had stopped killing each other. What do you mean killing each other? Let me explain the whole situation to you and you'll be able to understand better. First of all, it is important to explain that those who remained were not, as you might expect, the leaders, well protected in specially equipped shelters. The survivors, comprising three groups of blacks and five groups of yellows, had come, some from private shelters and others from large public shelters. Of course, at the time of the war, there were many more than 235 people in shelters. Indeed, it is believed there were over 800,000 in all. Following months of confinement in the darkness and intense cold, they were eventually able to risk going outside. The blacks ventured out first, finding almost no trees, no plants and no animals to speak of, on their continent. It was a group, isolated from their shelter in the mountains, who first knew cannibalism. Because of the lack of food, when the weakest died, they were eaten. Then, in order to eat, They had to kill each other, and that was the worst catastrophe on their planet. Another group, near the ocean, managed to survive by eating the only living things left on the planet, which were not too contaminated, that is, the mollusks, some fish and crustaceans. They still had unpolluted drinking water thanks to very ingenious installations enabling them to obtain water from incredible depths. Of course, many of these people still died, as a result of lethal radiation on the planet and from eating fish which were filled with radioactivity. Much the same course of events occurred in the Yellow's territory, so that, as I have said, 150 blacks and 85 yellows remained. Then finally, deaths resulting from the war ceased and reproduction began again. All of this occurred, in spite of all the warnings they had received. It should be said that before this almost total decimation, both the black race and the yellow race had attained a very high level of technological advance. The people lived in great comfort. They worked in factories, private and government enterprises, offices, just as happens now on your planet. They had a strong devotion to money which, to some, meant power and to others, wiser, it meant well-being. They worked on average 12 hours per week. On Bakar 18 a week comprises 6 days of 21 hours each. They tended to the material rather than the spiritual side of their existence. At the same time, they allowed themselves to be duped and led in circles by a structure of politicians and bureaucrats, exactly as is happening now on Earth. Leaders fool the masses with empty words and, motivated by greed or pride, they lead entire nations towards their downfall. Gradually, these two great races began to envy each other and, as there is only one step from envy to hate, eventually they hated each other so much and so completely that the catastrophe occurred. Both possessing very sophisticated arms, they achieved their mutual destruction. Our historical records show, then, that 235 survived the disaster, 6 of them being children. These statistics were recorded 5 years afterwards, and their survival is attributed to cannibalism and certain marine life. They reproduced, not always successfully as it was not uncommon for babies to be born with horrible misshapen heads or ugly weeping sores. They had to endure all the effects of atomic radiation on human beings. 150 years later, there were 190,000 blacks, men, women and children, and 85,000 yellows. I speak to you of this 150-year period because this was when both races began to re-establish and when we were able to help them materially. What do you mean? Just a few hours ago, you saw our spacecraft stop above the planet Homo X3 and take samples of soil, water and air. Did you not? I nodded. Then, Thau resumed, you watched as we quite easily annihilated a mass of giant ants as they attacked the inhabitants of a village. Indeed. In that particular case, we helped those people by intervening directly. You saw that they were living in a semi-wild state? Yes, but what happened on that planet? Atomic war, my friend. Always and eternally the same story. Don't forget, Michelle, that the universe is a gigantic atom and everything is affected by that. Your body is composed of atoms. My point is, in all galaxies, each time a planet is inhabited, at a certain stage in its evolution, the atom is discovered or rediscovered. Of course, the scientists who discover it are very soon aware that the disintegration of the atom can be a formidable weapon, and, at one moment or another, the leaders want to use it, just as a child with a box of matches is driven to set fire to a bale of straw in order to see what will happen. But, coming back to the planet Bakar 18, 150 years after the nuclear holocaust, we wanted to help these people. Their immediate need was food. Still they were subsisting essentially from products of the sea, resorting occasionally to cannibalism to satisfy their omnivorous yearnings. They needed vegetables and a source of meat. Vegetables, fruit trees, grains, animals, all that was edible had disappeared from the planet. There remain just enough inedible plants and bushes to replenish the oxygen in the atmosphere.